I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's April 16th, and we have a lot to talk about. And something that we often talk about on this podcast are disparities in healthcare. We've discussed evidence that shows members of historically underserved communities who are living with MS can face a more severe disease course. We've looked at studies that have shown some members of these racial and ethnic groups don't do as well on disease-modifying therapies, and they progress more quickly. It's often been speculated that the reason for all of this is based in genetics, that members of minority communities who are living with MS are genetically predisposed to experiencing a more severe disease course. My guest today is Dr. Annette Langer-Gould, and Dr. Langer-Gould comes armed with evidence that points to a completely different set of answers for racial and ethnic disparities in MS disease severity and progression. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Langer-Gould, there are a few other things that you should know about. If you're a regular listener, by now you know that I believe in the power of advocacy. And the reasons to be engaged in advocacy are, to me, obvious. Because of advocacy, we have the Affordable Care Act, which means that you can't be refused health insurance because your MS is a pre-existing condition. Because of advocacy, we have $20 million in federal funds earmarked for MS research in the 2024 federal budget. Because of advocacy, in another year, out-of-pocket costs for prescription drugs are being cut by two-thirds for the roughly 25% of the MS population that rely on Medicare for their insurance coverage. And on the state level, our advocacy efforts keep insurance companies from imposing rules and policies that are not in the best interest of people with MS, rules like step therapy or copay accumulator programs. And when I talk about the power of advocacy, I'm also talking about the power that you experience when you participate in advocacy. It's why I tell people that advocating on behalf of your own interests is one of the most empowering things you can do. Sharing your story and asking for support for a specific piece of legislation that you know will improve the quality of life for everyone living with MS, in that moment, you become a true difference maker. So if you're ready to collaborate and drive change for everyone affected by MS through activism, I want to invite you to participate in the virtual MS Activist Rally that's taking place on April 25th. You'll hear from keynote speakers, you'll be briefed on the progress of our current advocacy efforts, you'll connect with other MS activists in breakout sessions, and you'll have opportunities to engage with your elected officials online. It's an election year, and there's a lot at stake when it comes to your future healthcare options. This is the time when we truly need all available hands on deck. So I hope you'll find time to join the MS Activist Rally. You'll find a link to register in today's show notes. All regular vaccines work by teaching the immune system how to fight a specific threat. An inverse vaccine sort of does the opposite. It tells the immune system that something that would normally be a target is actually not a threat and should be left alone. In other words, an inverse vaccine instructs your immune system to tolerate something it would otherwise try to attack. And the reason I want to give you this quick lesson on how inverse vaccines work is because biotech company Nykode has developed an inverse vaccine that's been shown to prevent the mouse model of MS. This inverse vaccine delivers small DNA molecules to muscle cells, and these molecules instruct the muscle cells to produce a specific protein that, once it's circulated, targets the immune cells that call out those targets for the immune system to attack, promoting an immune response to those targets. Well, as you already know, in MS, the immune system mistakenly attacks the myelin sheath that surrounds and protects nerve cells in the brain and spinal cord. This particular inverse vaccine instructs the immune system to tolerate a myelin oligodendrocyte glycoprotein. I know that's a mouthful. And when they introduced this inverse vaccine to mice that had the mouse version of MS, the vaccine protected the mice, and they had very mild or no MS symptoms at all. Beyond stopping disease development, scientists also observed that the inverse vaccine delivered highly specific disease protection as well, and it does all this without impacting the other necessary functions of the immune system. Now, I hope you'll keep in mind that there's a vast difference between a mouse's central nervous system and a human's central nervous system, so there's a lot of work yet to be done in determining whether Nykode's inverse vaccine represents a potential treatment for people with MS. But this first step, at the very least, is promising. We'll certainly be keeping an eye on their progress as Nykode scientists continue their work. From its very beginning, the International Progressive MS Alliance has had a laser focus on advancing our understanding of progressive MS. And their focus extends far beyond scientific curiosity. The Alliance has invested millions of dollars in research to understand what drives progressive MS, to find ways to prevent and reverse progression, to increase the speed of clinical trials, and to improve the well-being of everyone living with progressive MS. In just a few short years, the Alliance research portfolio has grown to include 2 drug discovery networks, 1 imaging and clinical trials network, 6 new large-scale challenges in progressive MS awards, and 9 awards for studies aimed at improving well-being. And the Alliance will be announcing new experimental medicine awards later this year. The Progressive MS Alliance has put together a short video progress report. And if you're wondering about the efforts underway to solve the complex riddle of progressive MS, I'd recommend spending a few minutes watching this video. You'll find a link to the International Progressive MS Alliance 2024 Progress Report in today's show notes. It's getting pretty hard to follow the news these days without hearing about anti-diabetic and weight loss medications like Ozempic, Wegovy, or Mounjaro, and the dramatic success people are having by using them in their ongoing battle to lose weight. If you've somehow missed this, I'd recommend Googling Oprah Winfrey and you'll be all caught up. So why are we talking about these drugs on a podcast for the MS community? Well, because now evidence from the FDA shows that these same drugs are associated with reducing the risk of developing MS. The FDA maintains a publicly available database of drug side effects called the Adverse Event Reporting System. And by analyzing the number of MS-related adverse effects with certain specific drugs compared to all other drugs in the database, scientists can identify which drugs might reduce the risk of MS. So a research team analyzed all of the drugs used to treat diabetes and obesity and found that several of them were associated with reducing the risk of developing MS. Ozempic lowered the risk of developing MS by 76.2%. Trulicity lowered the risk by 83.5%. Victoza reduced the risk of developing MS by 83.9%. And Jardiance reduced the risk of developing MS by 76.6%. Now, many of these medications activate the GLP-1 receptor, which lowers blood sugar levels. And activating the GLP-1 receptor also seems to protect nerve cells from damage, promote nerve cell growth, and boost the integrity of the blood-brain barrier. These are all good things if you're trying to stop MS. And in previously published research, Trulicity has been shown to reduce the severity of MS symptoms, and Jardiance has been shown to delay the onset of these symptoms in the mouse model of MS. So as the research team points out, this may be an opportunity to repurpose these anti-diabetic and weight loss drugs for use as MS therapies. The obvious advantages of repurposing a drug that's already received FDA approval is that the drug's safety profile has already been established, which helps reduce the time it takes for a clinical trial. Not that these medications need to be any more popular than they already are, but you can expect to hear more about how they may be of benefit to people living with MS. If you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. It's been shown that the earlier an individual with MS starts a disease-modifying therapy, the better the outcome. The evidence points to fewer relapses and less severe disability compared to those who start treatment later in the disease course. So the guidelines for treating MS call for early intervention. And recently published study results reflect some good news. An analysis of data from MS registries in Germany, the United Kingdom, and the United States shows that in the years since 2017, people diagnosed with MS are starting their DMT sooner than were people diagnosed with MS between the years 2014 and 2016. In this study, researchers analyzed data from 5,395 people living with relapsing remitting MS. In Germany, the data came from the German MS Registry. In the UK, the data came from the United Kingdom MS Registry. And in the US, the data came from the North American Research Committee on MS Registry, or NARCOMS. However, that same research also demonstrates that early intervention is largely dependent upon the healthcare system of the country you happen to be living in. For example, most people in Germany are insured and receive reimbursement for their disease-modifying therapy from the day they're diagnosed. They don't need to reach any specified levels of disability, and their treatment can be prescribed by an outpatient neurologist and even some general practitioners. These extremely low barriers to accessing healthcare lead to people living with MS in Germany being diagnosed at a younger age, with only mild disability at the time of their diagnosis. On average, someone living in Germany receives an MS diagnosis within 3 months of experiencing their first symptoms and begins disease-modifying therapy 2 months after being diagnosed. By comparison, access to healthcare in the United States is largely regulated by private insurance companies, or in the case of Medicare and Medicaid, by federal and state governments. This unfortunately leads to tremendous disparities in accessing quality care. On average, someone living in the United States receives an MS diagnosis within 5 years of experiencing their first symptoms, and they begin disease-modifying therapy 3 months after being diagnosed. In the United Kingdom, an individual must be seen by a general practitioner first before being referred to a neurologist, making the process of confirming an MS diagnosis an even more drawn-out and complicated undertaking. On average, someone living in the UK receives an MS diagnosis within 1.5 years of experiencing their first symptoms and begins disease-modifying therapy 7 to 9 months after being diagnosed. Despite these dramatic differences between each country's healthcare system, the researchers discovered that in the years since 2017, individuals diagnosed with MS in all three countries were starting a DMT more quickly than individuals diagnosed with MS in the past. So the study points out the good news, that people are getting the message about the value and importance of early intervention. It also points out how systemic barriers to accessing care play a major role in how early that intervention will really be. Now, if you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. Accessing healthcare within the United States can be further complicated by institutional bias that's embedded into, well, not only our healthcare system, but most every other aspect of our society. And this has a direct effect on many facets of life, including how Americans receive treatment for MS. In a moment, we'll explore this important topic with my guest, Dr. Annette Langer-Gould. In past episodes of this podcast, we've discussed apparent differences in the MS disease course among members of minority communities. By example, it's been observed that members of the Black community experience more severe MS symptoms and seem to progress to greater physical disability compared to white people living with MS. Now, the question that's often asked is why? And it's been speculated that there are genetic differences driving this more severe disease course. This past February at the ACTRIMS Forum, my guest, Dr. Annette Langer-Gould, participated in a debate that focused on this proposition: racial and ethnic disease phenotype differences are driven by genetics. Dr. Langer-Gould is a neurologist who specializes in MS at Kaiser Permanente. Welcome back to the podcast, Dr. Langer-Gould.
Thank you so much for having me, John. I'm really excited to talk about this topic that's been near and dear to my heart and our team has been working on for over 15 years. So glad to be here.
Well, when I saw you last at the ACTRIMS Forum, you were at the podium debating a hot topic. Although I will say that both you and Dr. Phil DeAger, who argued the other side of this issue, were actually in general agreement on most of the salient points that you each raised. So let me restate that debate topic as a question. Are racial and ethnic disparities in MS susceptibility and prognosis genetic?
No, I don't think so. And I don't think the evidence supports that notion that there's a genetic component to this. And there's sort of three main themes underlying my argument. One is that we know that differences in outcomes in MS, that there is no strong genetic component. There's at most sort of like a 1% contribution. So from identical twin studies, even the onset phenotype, whether they have relapsing remitting MS or primary progressive MS, there's no correlation even when you have you're genetically identical to someone else who has MS. The other issue is that, of course, susceptibility, there is a genetic component, but it is small. In identical twin studies, it accounts for no more than 18% of the reason people get MS. So it's to say, you know, at least 80% of the reason people get MS has nothing to do with their genes. And then the third one is that there's a much better explanation, which is called embodied racism. So the way in which structural racism and systemic racism impact how people in minoritized communities live, starting from birth all the way through adulthood, impacts their biology, which influences the risk of MS and also the chances of having worse outcomes.
So before we dive into some of that, and we will, maybe you can help us understand what we do know about racial and ethnic disparities in MS.
Yeah, I think that's a really important question. We know for over a decade now that MS is more common in the Black community in the United States. It was believed to be a disease of white people, but in our population in Southern California, we were finally able to study that question carefully, and we found that the incidence is actually higher, particularly among Black women compared to white and Hispanic and Asian women. Now, the risk of MS is lower in the Hispanic community in the United States overall, but in that very youngest age segment, so people under the age of 25, it's actually quite similar to white people and a little bit higher in young Black people. So that's super concerning because we know young people are at higher risk of having relapses, and they're also more likely to be un- and underinsured in this country, particularly if they're minoritized individuals. The good news is they're also the ones that respond best to treatments. So if we can get them the treatments and make sure they're able to continue to afford them and take them, then we could have a huge impact on sort of removing some of those disparities.
So now that we understand the disparities, let's talk about embodied racism. And I'm hoping you'll explain two terms, structural racism and social determinants of health.
So systemic and structural racism and social determinants of health are intertwined concepts. Systemic is really easy. It's just the system. Structural are the actual policies and laws that reinforce that systemic belief that people should be discriminated against. And so there are things like redlining in homeowner lending policies, you know, 400 years of laws in the United States that reinforce this idea that Black and other non-white groups are somehow less worthy or should have less wealth and less opportunities in this country than white people do. And it doesn't require an individual perpetrator because it's all driven by the laws. So it's like redlining and homeowner lending policies, restricting which neighborhoods people can live in, access to lower quality education, lower pay for the same jobs, and of course, criminalization and sentencing policies, and more recently in indigenous populations, the family separation policies has gotten a lot of interest. And social determinants of health is simply the conditions in which we live that affect our health. It includes healthcare access and healthcare quality, but it also includes things like crowded neighborhoods that, you know, can lead to more infections, living in unsafe spaces without a nice park nearby, without good grocery stores nearby, making it difficult to exercise and get access to healthy foods. The nearest hospital is really far away or it's understaffed. So it's almost impossible to get in to see a neurologist in the case of people with MS. Those are all parts of the conditions in which we live that affect our health. And of course, systemic and structural racism lead to huge disadvantages on a group level for people in minoritized communities.
So we can actually connect the dots from structural racism to the social determinants of health to the biology shared by members of racial or ethnic groups that are victimized by what may actually start out as these social constructs. Am I getting that right?
Yes. One thing we hadn't talked about is that race and ethnicity is not a distinct biological entity. So there is no genetic underpinning that says we can't do a genetic test and say, aha, yes, you're white. Aha, yes, you are Hispanic. Oh, yes, you are Asian. Genetic ancestry is about the continent where your ancestors came from, and it may or may not have anything to do with how you identify. And technically, we all came out of Africa. So it's, you know, the entire human species originates from there. But that doesn't mean that most of us identify as African. So I think that's also a really important point, that these are social constructs in order to uphold a power structure that greatly benefits white people. And in the terms of MS susceptibility, we can connect the dots. There are some pretty good studies out there showing that Black people get infected with Epstein-Barr virus at a younger age, and they're also more likely to show continuous sort of reactivation of that, which is a sign of stress and a dysregulated immune response to Epstein-Barr virus. And we know that is a major risk factor for MS. Other potential factors that may be at play are an abnormal gut microbiome from less likely to have vaginal births, be born vaginally, less likely to be breastfed, less likely to have adequate access to healthy foods, and childhood and adolescent obesity, which is a strong risk factor for developing multiple sclerosis.
Those factors actually influence prognosis.
We know that Black people get MS more often than white people do in the United States, and we know that it affects them when they're younger. And so why is that? What are some plausible explanations and ones for which we already have some evidence? And the way I think about it is they have a higher burden of risk factors for developing multiple sclerosis already at younger ages, which is probably why we're seeing that. In terms of prognosis, I think the elephant in the room is access to disease-modifying therapies. They need to have consistent access at a young age and be able to be compliant with these medications. And that is very likely not happening in the United States. And that's probably why we see worse outcomes. So no studies have sort of specifically addressed whether the reason we see that Black men and women die of MS at younger ages than white men and women with MS is because not only they're getting it younger, but then they're also not really getting access to good treatments to slow down that disease or stop it in its tracks. And I think in the United States, we know that Black and other non-white individuals are more likely to have gaps in insurance. Underinsured is the buzzword for Medicaid. People with Medicaid are much less likely to be able to get in to even see a neurologist. Without seeing a neurologist, you can't get a prescription for a DMT. And even when they finally get in to see a neurologist, they're more likely to be handed a treatment that they're not going to be able to comply with. So it's something they would have to pick up from the pharmacy every month, has a very expensive copay, needs to be taken once or twice a day. You know, when you're young and you're feeling pretty invincible, you know, taking a pill twice a day isn't like top priority. When you're even a little older and you're busy and you've got to get to work, and if you don't get to work, you don't get paid, or your work is always constantly changing and you're moving in and out of health insurance, it's difficult to take medications on a regular basis. Actually, in the United States, most people don't take pills on a regular basis. So compliance with just a once-a-day pill is pretty low. So getting 100% compliance, even in people who are wealthy. So we kind of already know that. So how that then plays out in MS, they finally get in to see a neurologist, and then they're handed dimethyl fumarate or fingolimod, which are now generic and super cheap, but they can't really take them on a regular basis.
You know, as you were describing some of the challenges of just getting in to be seen by a neurologist, I've heard the term healthcare by zip code. Is that what we're kind of describing here? Is that something that actually impacts the health outcomes among minority populations?
Certainly where you live matters a lot, but probably more importantly is what kind of insurance you have. You know, the zip codes are used as sort of, it's assuming that everybody in that neighborhood has similar income, similar education status. But the zip code also does tell you where is the nearest hospital and what kind of hospital is it? And do they even have a neurologist on staff? And if they have a neurologist, do they know anything about MS? Or are they going to be that neurologist that says, oh, here we have 18 different medications for MS, go home, read about it, come back and tell me which one you want. And of course, that, generally speaking, doesn't work very well. That approach has not worked. You know, we've shown that in Kaiser. You do that approach, even with a lot of white people, one in every five of your patients who are on treatment will be relapsing and having pretty significant relapses. So we know that that's not a good option. In rural areas, perhaps the zip code is a stronger predictor because it tells you a lot more about how far they even have to go to get seen.
Let me ask a somewhat related question here. It seems hard to believe, but my listeners remind me that there are still neurologists who tell their Black patients that they can't have MS because MS only affects white women. So is this a generational thing that will eventually disappear? Or do medical schools have to present multiple sclerosis differently than it's traditionally been taught? What has to change here?
Yeah, what has to change? You're right. Absolutely. This is very frustrating. I mean, we presented those findings in 2011. We published them in 2013. And there are still people out there saying Black people don't get MS, still teaching that to their students, still writing that in review articles, still saying it's a paradox. And they're going to look for that protective genetic feature in Black people that protects them from getting MS. Paper published recently from a prominent group on that, that exact topic. It is generational for sure. The easiest way to change that thinking is to change how you teach it in medical school and what you're doing, raising awareness amongst the community and amongst physicians that is an outdated notion and that it was never really supported by strong evidence to begin with. And now there is lots of strong evidence pointing in the other direction.
Every time I attend a research conference, I always hear all the evidence being presented about what MS actually is, what we actually know about it, and what scientists continue to learn about it. And I think to myself, with all of this information, it can't still be taught, it can't still be communicated that Black people can't get MS, that it's a white woman's disease. And then I think to myself, maybe the problem is the folks who most need to hear that among healthcare providers are the ones who don't attend the conference. So I tend to think very often the people at the conference are sort of preaching to the choir, but it's not filtering down as quickly as we'd like to see.
Yes. And I'm hoping that our younger generation will change that, that they'll be like, actually, no, there are studies showing that it is more common in Black women than it is in white women. And it's actually more common. It's just as common in Black men as it is in white men. So I think the thinking has to change. But I think before you brought up another really good point, which is discrimination in medicine. And it's real. You know, we hear anecdotal stories from our patients all the time. Sometimes it's It's overt, and you can see it in the notes that they treat their Black patients differently. But most of the time, it's just implicit bias. Like they don't think of themselves as racist, but the care they're delivering is racist. So a good example would be not asking a young person of color whether they were taking their medication, or presenting the question in a way that makes them feel bad if they were to admit that it's actually difficult for them to afford the medication or pick it up or raise issues that cross the white-Black line. And so telling their white male physician that it's really hard for me to take that medicine, it's actually really expensive, and not giving them that opening. We hear those stories all the time, and we see it, that they're just basically too afraid to raise those issues during their clinic visits, and the physicians don't give them the opening for that. I think our duty as physicians, we know how fractured the U.S. healthcare system is, and we know how much it disadvantages Black and Hispanic patients and other non-white individuals. We should be the ones reaching out to them and trying to close that gap for them.
Well, I think the gap closes just a little bit every single time you have an opportunity to educate us. So thank you for this conversation. As we say, it's another brick in the wall. And and hopefully we continue to build that wall till we don't have to anymore. And Dr. Annette Langer-Gould, thank you for all you do to improve the lives of everyone living with MS. And thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, John. I really appreciate it. And thank you for all you do for the MS community.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/346. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or a text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes. And it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.